Yes, good day. I mean, the show hasn't even begun, and I'm having the best day.
Yeah, a couple of minutes ago, the door at the station flies open, and rocketing through the door is Mr. McEnroe wearing, well, let's just put it this way. Somewhere today, Susie, the Time Life operator, is running around without a headset. You got it.
Hands-free headphone.
Oh, it goes to your cell phone?
Yeah, hands-free cell phone.
It looks like one of those sports things they wear, you know, yeah, like the Ambrosio
wears. So I could bark out orders as I was coming, racing. I mean, let me just say that I left the state capitol at 20 of 3. And I was here.
Yeah,
I could have done the tease. I was here. I got here in 18 minutes.
You raced in.
Yeah. I had to park in the fire lane. And anyway, while I was there, and we're about to join our news ace, Matt Dwyer, who's over there at the state capitol right now. But Matt and I were both in the chamber for the House Select Committee today as a pretty fiery drama unfolded. And I don't know if you heard Matt's report, but basically what happened was today was the day that the committee had asked for, they had subpoenaed the Rolands, and they had said, on Friday at 2 p.m., we want you in here under oath talking about where your records are and why we don't have them, or we want your designee, what they call your custodian, in here under oath explaining why, where the records are and stuff like that. Well, instead what happened was, first of all, the counsel, Steve Reich, the counsel of the committee, got up there and sort of explained, as he put it, how we got to this point and what the committee's level and history of frustration was about these records. And then Willie Dow, the lawyer for Governor Roland, got up in front of the microphone and explained that A, Governor Roland wasn't there, and that B, although he, William Dow, was there, despite what the committee might have been led to believe, he was not going to go under oath and he was not going to testify to anything. As he put it, I'm a lawyer, not a witness. Taking a little page from DeForest Kelly's book. And I'm a lawyer, Jim, not a witness. And so at that point, he wanted to sort of, he had also filed a motion to quash the subpoena. And at that point, he kind of wanted to get into a dialogue with the committee about why he wanted to quash this subpoena, why it wasn't fair to ask for this stuff, yada, yada. And John Wayne Fox, one of the two chairs of the committee, just sort of basically asked him a few questions. He said, basically, so what you're saying is, Roland's not here, you're not going to testify. Well, you know what? Your motion's out of order. I don't really want to hear anything more from you. Thanks for coming. But we don't have anything more to say to one another. He in so many words. John Wayne Fox said.
Yeah.
Now, at that point, I followed Willie Dow out into the hall. Now, Willie Dow, who's a very sort of distinguished and kind of pricey-looking lawyer, he did one of those things where he had a sort of violent and noisy interaction with the door as he left the committee. And then he did one of those things where he shot a glance over his shoulder just to make sure that people had noticed that he'd had this violent and noisy interaction.
Did he throw a chair or anything?
No, he just kind of yanked the door open or something. He did something to make a big noise. I couldn't exactly figure out what, but yeah. It was, he had a violent and noisy interaction with the
Punctuate his exit.
I would be prepared to testify under oath anyway that he had a violent and noisy interaction with the semi-violent and noisy interaction with the door. And then out in the hall, he began by saying, I am enraged. And then he went on to basically say that he felt his clients were being set up and his client was being... Well, meanwhile,
right, yeah. Uh-huh.
And here we are joined by Matt Dwyer, because this is the part that I missed. At that point, I kind of had to jump in the car and come out here. But Matt Dwyer, who's still up there at the state capitol, back in the House Select Committee, John Wayne Fox took this occasion to do what? Matt, are you there?
Hi. Yes, hi. Colin, I'm here. I'm actually speaking to you from the Capitol press room right now. Essentially, the committee co-chair, John Wayne Fox, and then questioned Attorney Casal, who represents the First Lady, Patricia Roland. Actually, much of that questioning was the same as the questioning they had for William Dow, for the governor's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, he asked him verbatim a lot of the same questions, simply trying to ask him if he would go on record and testify on behalf of the First Lady, Patricia Roland. And his responses were much the same. He said essentially he would not. He was there as a lawyer, and that he was not prepared to testify on behalf of Patricia Roland at this point. The committee chairman or co-chairman William also said and asked whether or not Mr. Casal would be able to have the First Lady come and testify at some point in the future about whether or not she had actually made any efforts to get the personal financial documents that the committee is seeking.
Yeah, we should explain a little bit about this, because this is one of the reasons the committee is mad. They basically asked the Rowlands for some of this information. Now, we're talking about bank records and credit card statements going pretty far back.
About 10 years, I believe.
Yeah, 10 years back. And what the committee staff is saying is, look, at a certain point when the Rowlands realized they didn't have this stuff, they could ask the financial institutions. And because of an agreement we crafted with the Rowlands, we said, all right, you go and ask the financial institutions, you get that stuff, because, in fact, they were going to give the Rowlands a chance to redact certain kinds of highly personal information. I don't really know what those things were, but maybe they were charging, well, who knows what. Use your imagination. And anyway, so what they're now saying is that there's no evidence that the Rowlands ever did that. No evidence that the Rowlands ever contacted these financial institutions. Meanwhile, they finally said, well, screw it. We'll contact the financial institutions. At which point they were told, and if you've ever tried to get these kinds of records, I mean, you know what this is like. At which point they were told, for example, I think Steve Reich said by Fleet, just for example, it would take 3 weeks. Well, the 3 weeks started, you know, pretty much like now, and the committee is very frustrated about that, because they would have had this stuff, you know, they would already had it in their hands for 3 weeks if the Rowlands had made the request when they were originally told to do so. So that's what some of the frustration is about. Now, my understanding of that is that John Wayne Fox then sort of took this as an occasion. Did he instruct the staff to draft an article of impeachment based on all this?
Yes, essentially, that's exactly what he did. He spoke to the committee's lawyer, Mr. Reich, Stephen Reich, and asked him to draft, I guess, what essentially could add a new potential ground for impeachment, on that being the governor's and the first refusal to turn over these documents, and his delays in that area.
Well, not only does it add a new ground, but this would really be the first time anybody's ever talked about drafting an article of impeachment, right? I mean, this is a kind of watershed moment.
Yes, and ultimately that would still have to be voted on, and it would have to come back to the committee after it's drafted.
Yeah.
So, it's not actually been empowered or enacted yet.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, Matt, thanks very much. I guess now the committee has adjourned, I'm assuming, for the day. I don't know what else they could actually do, but...
Yep, they're actually at the moment, they're down there simply taking reporters' questions and talking amongst themselves.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Go ask them questions.
What would be the, what's the strategy here for the governor not to give these people the financial records?
Well, this is a chess match, and the chess match goes kind of like this. And obviously, the governor is trying to run time off the clock. That's the only strategy he really has left, is to run time off the clock.
This doesn't make any... I mean, I understand what you're saying, but if you honk off this entire committee, what difference does it make how much time comes off the clock?
Well, that's the chess match. In other words, how uncooperative can you be before you exhaust the patience of the committee and get them to do something fairly catastrophic? And we got our answer on April 30th around 2:30 in the afternoon.
But is he trying to get them to do that?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No. I mean, basically, I think that their basic goal was, let's not cooperate, let's take forever. You know, we don't know where this stuff is, and we don't care, and they want it, and we don't want to provide it, and, you know, why should we bother? But more than that, the longer that everything takes... you know, and just to sort of give you a sense of this, Willie Darrow, at one point, when he was sort of explaining kind of how things had come to this pass on his end, said, well, you know, I was told that there wasn't going to be any meetings on the week of the 19th, and so I had this vacation plan to go see one of my daughters, and so I did that, so, you know, and so I was away for a while, and I got back. And I'm, you know, everybody in the committee room is sitting there thinking, they're impeaching the freaking governor. You're his lawyer. You're not supposed to go on vacation to see your daughter. You know, you think Sam Ervin went water skiing during Watergate? I don't think so. Maybe once. But yeah, I mean, really, you know, this is kind of a situation where, you know, if you're counsel to a governor who's going to be impeached, you don't go off and, you know, to an ultimate frisbee tournament in Fresno or something. You know, you just stay here. So don't tell us about that. But I think it really is a measure of, in fact, the kind of Dean Smith four-corner strategy that the governor and his lawyers are in, basically just tossing the ball around and trying to get the clock run down as far as they can. Now, the difference, of course, is that when Dean Smith used to do this, he was ahead of the game. He had the leading score for North Carolina,
right.
Whereas now the governor is
we're not being 56 points behind.
Right. He just doesn't want them to score any more points. And so, I mean, that's the strategy. And the answer is, okay, our patience is exhausted today. That's basically what the committee was telling him. And I'm assuming John Wayne Fox, in doing what he did, had conferred at least with Arthur O'Neill and his Republican counterpart, and probably the whole committee knew that this was coming. Now, this is, it's a watershed moment, and then again it isn't. You know, it's a watershed moment in the sense that the committee now is saying, well, we've got something that already constitutes, as far as we're concerned, possible grounds, at least grounds to draw up an article of impeachment. And it's sort of just non-compliance. You know what? You're not going to do what we ask you to do when we file subpoenas. You know, and like nobody shows up. That's what basically happened today. The governor was subpoenaed on last Sunday, I believe the subpoena was filed. Around 11:20 last night, his counsel responded, I think, in some way to indicate that I can't remember. Maybe the motion to quash was filed this morning, and some other kind of letter was delivered last night. But the fact that you know there was not going to be a high level of cooperation today. And when the governor was subpoenaed last Sunday, he was told that, okay, well, if you can't come, you know, because we're trying to be cooperative, we're trying to be mensch's, if you can't show up, then, you know, send somebody, and we'll put him under oath as your custodian, and that person can answer the questions. But the committee was not prepared to countenance, I think, today, the idea that nobody was going to show up to answer the subpoena. Instead, this guy in a pinstripe suit was going to show up and mouth off to them about how he was a lawyer and not a witness.
Right.
And, well, I mean, the committee's answer was, well, if you're not a witness, somebody else's ass better be a witness, all right? And nobody else's ass was. So they're mad and they draft an article.
Okay, yeah.
That's what's going on.
All right.
Oh, I love stuff like this.
20 after 3. We're Bruce and Colin.
I'm Ray Dunaway.
I'm Diane Smith.
It's the weekend. News.
End of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.
I just wanted you to know that if it ever comes down to it and you're supposed to go testify someplace and you don't want to do it, I'll go do it for you
if you
want.
You'll be my custodian.
Yeah, I'll
custodian
do
custodian of my records. Poor you. You probably want to go to jail, by the way, so don't make that off a rattler. Well, there's another component to all this that's now the talk of the state capitol. But when I got to the state capitol today, everybody was talking about something else. They were talking about the famous $120,000. Now, the famous $120,000 was included in this budget that was, in fact, voted out of the House last night. This morning at 4 a.m. Always a good time to...
Right. People usually thinking they're best at 4 o'clock.
You know, if you have to sort of wake up...
I just mentioned Art Bell, for an example.
Right. Okay. If you have to sort of wake up where you're sleeping at your desk, vote on the state budget, you know, the $14.3 billion state budget, and then go pee, basically, because you've been sleeping at your desk for 3 hours, it's not a good thing, all right? So anyway, but one of the things that's in this 14
point... Oh, that just conjured up some awful...
Yeah.
Just, oh.
Really, you probably can't even get a urinal for the first 20 minutes. The $14.3 billion budget includes $120,000 and $120,550 for other expenses, as they call them, in the lieutenant governor's office. Now, basically, this line represents...
Another jet ski.
Well, no. It's Kevin Sullivan apparently put this in with the idea that if the governor gets impeached, Jody has got to move all of her crap out of one place and into another, and presumably he's got to move all of his crap out of one place and into Jody's office, and that's what this is all about.
For $120,000?
Well, it's transition costs. Who knows what else that is? I don't really know.
But let's rent a U-Haul. We could do it for half that.
You know, look, when you find out what it costs to move a hot dog back and forth,
you got a point.
They're more
expensive
than you think they're going to be. I don't really know what the it's transition costs, basically. And Sullivan actually said when he was asked that he pulled this number out of a hat. I don't think he literally did that. And, you know, although the House Select Committee may subpoena the hat at some point. But it's just a, you know, it's a made-up number. Now, and he says that he put it in the budget of the lieutenant governor's office so as not to have it be a slap in the face by... If you put it in the governor's office, in the governor's budget, the cost of getting you out of here, that would really be kind of assaultive. But anyway, this is, of course, been, and then apparently, and this is Keith Faniff and Sue Haig, who's, Keith is from the JI and Sue is from AP, they have this other little thing where basically Sue Haig apparently asked them, isn't it a little premature? We don't know, A, if he's going to be impeached, or B, if he's going to be removed from office. And Sullivan, according to this AP account, said, you know, you can always hope, which is a pretty funny answer. But the problem with this is that Kevin has been one of the people who earlier on in the process said, let's not have anybody staking out any positions about this, because first of all, if we eventually have to vote on any of this, it's, you know, you don't want to have said anything that's potentially prejudicial. Well, then he just went and broke his own rule, basically. So when Willie Dow, the governor's lawyer, came storming out into the hall after he had vented a while at the committee and said what a bunch of royal pains in the neck they were, he said, and I understand that the president pro tem is measuring the lieutenant governor's office for drapes right now because it's all, you know. I'm not really doing a very good impersonation of Willie Dow, but that's basically what he was saying. He's saying, well, if Kevin's got $120,000 so he can put new drapes in, you know, in the lieutenant governor's office when he moves in, it doesn't sound like this is a real process. And so that's the other. I mean, I'll just let that hang in the air. You can decide.
There'd be another fundraiser in this one. I mean, another, yeah. The extreme makeover home version.
Well, don't get me started about this, because also there's also, I guess we have to go, right? Yeah. Well, there's another piece to this, but we'll mention it later.
On Tuesday, July 27th, you won't want to miss Carole King at the Mohegan Sun Arena.
Soft in the middle now. Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. Bone digger, bone digger. Dogs in the moonlight. Far away, my well-lit door. Just a beer, belly, beer, belly. Get these mutts away.
Joining us now is he's the superstar of the fledgling Air America network. And of course,
the what?
He's the superstar. He's there.
Oh, I know he's a superstar. What did you say? Fledgling?
But they are fledgling, aren't they?
Because we've been doing left-of-center talk radio, 53 years? These guys are newcomers.
But joining us now is Al Franken. We're very pleased to have him.
Thank you.
How's your physical constitution holding up under the rigors of talk radio?
It's getting better and better. the hardest week was the launch week.
Yeah. No, you'll find that arc doesn't stay steady like that. You'll have some downturns. We're warning you.
Oh, I bet. I mean, it was just the launch week. I was doing so much publicity to promote the launch that it was and launching at the same time that I was basically getting very little sleep.
Well, that's going to change. As a matter of fact, all you have to do is turn on C-SPAN, and you'll doze right off. That's what we do anyway. In addition to all that, you got to put the gloves on and come here to Hartford next week to do battle with Ann Coulter, right?
Yes. I agreed to do that.
Don't take that tone. We're very excited about this. We don't get bloodbaths that don't involve our actual governor here in Connecticut.
Poor guy.
Talk a little bit about this. Have you and Ann Coulter sort of faced each other in this kind of a format in the past?
No. This is going to be interesting. We have never. I've only met her once, this will be our second time meeting,
yeah.
And the first time we talked for a minute or so, and so I think that this will be very different.
Okay, well, I don't find any inconsistencies with your statement so far anyway. You've met her once, and this will be the second time.
Yeah.
Today, what did you talk about on your show?
Well, we talked, one of the things we talked about was Wolfowitz not knowing how many Americans had died, American troops had died in Iraq.
You can just watch Nightline.
Huh?
You can just watch Nightline. You can find that out.
Well, that's why you should watch Nightline. But he was in front of a House Appropriations Subcommittee. And on foreign, appropriations, and he was asked by a congresswoman how many Americans had died, and she was doing it to make a point, because right now that a lot of these Humvees don't have armor, and instead of Doors. And he said about 500 approximately have died and about 350 in combat.
Mm.
But I'll get to the actual numbers. And, of course, the actual numbers are 738 now and over 500 in combat. And this is the Deputy Secretary of Defense who doesn't know how many of our troops have been killed in Iraq, and I found that shocking.
In his defense, he also thought that Babe Ruth had hit about 500 home runs.
Yeah, so that's about the same. Yeah, his offside is about the same.
Yeah, he's just not good with numbers, that's all. The thing that I'm fascinated by today, we haven't had a chance to get into this on our show, partly because we actually do have hand grenades being thrown up at our own state capitol today, but not literally, but is this Fallujah pullback where, from what I can tell, what they're planning to do in Iraq now in Fallujah is, like, let people out of prison to be an army to quell the insurrection. I mean, they're just sort of like, they're taking all the guys that we used to say were bad guys, and we're saying, and saying, all right.
I'm not sure they're taking guys out of prison. I think they're allowing guys back who we had sort of said, you're not in the military. We got rid of their military. We disbanded their military.
Yeah.
Which was something that we shouldn't have done, which was something that was in all the planning that was done by the CIA and by the State Department and by the, you know, Future of Iraq Project in the State Department produced a 2,500-page document. One of the things it said was don't disband the military.
Mm-hmm.
And other things they said was, you know, don't allow there to be looting and get the electric grid right away and, you know, General Shinseki, the chief of staff of the army, said he was going to need several hundred thousand troops, and he was humiliated, and Wolfowitz said that this was not going to cost much because the oil would be up right away, and that would pay for the reconstruction, and Natsios from the State Department said it was going to cost $1.7 billion to the U.S. taxpayers to reconstruct Iraq, and on and on and on and on. And
well, I just want to come back to this Fallujah thing, and I'll read to you from the New York Times. I'm sure you've already read this article. It's right there on page one. One paragraph leapt out at me. It was not exactly clear who the Iraqi soldiers were who would quell the insurgency, how closely they were linked to the often brutal forces of the Hussein government, or the degree of their loyalty to Americans.
Yep.
So basically what they're saying is, we're tired of getting our asses kicked in Fallujah. You guys go do it, all right? We'll be over in East Fallujah. We just noticed some really bad stuff happening over in East Fallujah. We're going to go over there, and you guys, who used to be the bad guys, you're in charge now, okay?
No, this is a problematic, as I heard someone call it yesterday, from the Saban Institute at Brookings. This is, we don't really know how this is going to work. But it doesn't bode terribly well if this is our plan.
I think we sort of do know how this is going to work.
Yeah, I think you're right. Badly.
The lessons of painful experience. I want to just flip over to the thing that sort of triggered your thing about Wolfowitz, which is the Nightline thing. And, you know, I'm sort of surprised. I have to assume that if somebody's reaction is that a reading of the names of the soldiers who've been slain, just a reading of their names and the showing of their pictures without attendant commentary, represents some kind of critique of the American military presence or strategy over in Iraq, people who feel that way, I think, must have guilty consciences.
I think they're just right-wing. I mean, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group is just a right-wing company, and they don't. You know, the president doesn't want caskets shown, and they don't want to actually put out numbers of wounded. And they are very reticent to let people see what the human cost is, and this will bring it out very vividly. And they don't want this.
But it just seems to me that if you are going to say that a reading without any commentary of these things...
I'm with you. Totally with you.
You're basically admitting that you feel guilty about something.
Well, I don't think, you know, I don't know how many of these people feel guilty. Which is, I mean, to me, the shamelessness of Wolfowitz not knowing... I mean, I know how many troops have died. I do it by... I watch the news, I read the newspaper. I mean, I'm not the Deputy Secretary of Defense. It's not like a secret. And if you pay attention, you know how many is. This is shocking to me. This is absolutely shocking. And it means, and it's quite apart from it being, they're feeling guilty, these people feeling guilty, I think these people don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the opposite.
Yeah.
And I think that they think it's just bad for the war effort, that they don't want to see what happened in Vietnam, which is more the people saw body bags, the more they saw caskets, the more they turned against the war. Now, they're obviously, you know, in World War II, we lost 400,000 troops.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew we had to fight that war. This is now 738, and that's, you know, we would lose those, you know, in an hour on Iwo Jima.
Yeah. I guess
so it's not about, it's really more about why are we doing this? Is this worth it? Do we know what we're doing? Did the president do the proper, and did Wolfowitz and those people do the proper planning? It is the moral obligation of, we know this president is not a curious man, but when Colin Powell said, you know, it's the Pottery Barn rule, if you break it, you own it.
Mm-hmm.
It's incumbent upon the president, even if he isn't interested in the culture of Iraq, the history of Iraq, I don't care about botany, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And that's fine. I don't care that the president doesn't care about Iraq. It's still his duty, mm-hmm. his moral obligation to inform himself and to plan for not just the war itself, the part of the war that's taking over, that's ousting Saddam, mm-hmm. but this part of the war, the post-invasion Iraq. And they did such a bad job of this. Now, one of those things that those reports said, every one of those reports, you know, they did a year of planning, the CIA and the State Department and the Army War College, and they all said, don't allow looting.
Right.
And Wolfowitz, in April of 2003, when the looting started, said, well, you know, people in a free society are free to do bad things if they want. Well, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. We're not free to loot in our society. And
well,
that's
only if your college wins the NCAA basketball game,
that's true.
You're free to loot.
You're allowed to turn over a car.
Yeah, all right.
we're not allowed to loot. And it sent a message to the Iraqis that we didn't care about them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Well, Al Franken, we're excited to have you on the show today, and congratulations in your new role. Good luck against Ann Coulter. She will probably hit low. I would wear some kind of protection.
I should wear like a cup?
I'm saying cup, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have an athletic path. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted you to know that we got a fax from the White House saying that they've replaced the Pottery Barn principle with the Lord and Taylor principle, which is we take the if out of gift. It's a new strategy for Iraq. Thanks for joining
us. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
I think I've finally recovered now.
From
Al. At me laughing.
I think Al's getting a little mired in the... I mean, I respect the guy for, you know, having gone from being primarily a comedian to really informing himself fully about this. And I'm sure as his talk show arc continues, he'll balance this out a little bit better. But, I mean, I wouldn't presume to give Al Franken advice because he's a big star and I'm not. But
right.
he might want to think about making this stuff a little bit more entertaining. Thinking about something, quote-unquote, funny to say about these things. But
yeah, because Wolfowitz only missed by, what, 270 years?
Right.
Oh, well, I don't know if it was that many, but he didn't miss by much.
Yeah.
Just 200 or 300 people.
And it's a forgivable Wolfowitzian error.
Well, not really, but
yeah.
Anyway.
So anyway, if you're just tuning in, we do have a lot of other stuff coming up here, including a conversation with Christopher Morano, who's chief state's attorney, who was one of the few people not able to get their bizarre proposal through the state legislature. Everybody else is having a pretty good day because, you know, I mean, the way things are out there right now, it's not exactly that it's kindergarten and there's no teacher, but there are just possibilities at a time of civil chaos.
That 120,000, yeah. I think we could do wonders with that. This is for basically what, moving, I guess, right?
Well, it's not clear. It really does...
But it would involve at least moving.
It is a category known as other expenses.
So, say, for example, Jody Rell had to move from her office to the governor's office. Because, there's a minor likelihood that the governor might be impeached at some time or leave office or resign or whatever.
Yeah.
Didn't it used to be, you basically packed up your stuff in a box and you took it and put it in the new place? What do you need $120,000 for?
Big party.
That might be part of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And I just, all I would say is I do think this was sort of a, unless I'm missing something here, which is quite possible. I mean, maybe I'm not seeing the chess match for what it was. But I actually think this was sort of a wrong note sounded by Kevin Sullivan, because, in fact, this process, the governor is imploding anyway. It's like when they took down 60 Washington Street, except it's happening in slow motion. Man, it's just, he's just imploding without the tiniest shove. He's gone. And for those of you just tuning in or just kind of touching base with the current news cycle, things get so bad before the House Select Committee today that they did, in fact, ask staff to draft an article of impeachment. It was entirely about the failure of the governor and his lawyers to cooperate with anything. what they do is then they go in the hall of the lawyers and they say, yeah, well, we gave them like 28,000 pieces of paper. Well, that's fine, but you've got to give them the pieces of paper they asked for, not the ones that you decided you wanted to give them. Even Willie Dow, the enraged lawyer for John Rowland, was able to use this Kevin Sullivan thing as a rhetorical flourish to say, they're already bagging my guy, and they're measuring the office for drapes, and
if it comes down to moving the governor out, it were a matter of getting the money for that, I think we could take up a collection and have a sizable amount of money in no time.
Or just sort of an Amish kind of thing where everybody shows up
and moves.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. Like the old barn race.
Right, this would be like a scene out of Witness. Actually, there's a lot of things that are like a scene out of Witness, but...
It's funny, that Witness tie-in.
Yeah. Or, of course, as Willie Dow kept saying, I'm a lawyer, Jim, not a witness.
This stuff would be out on the lawn in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I really do think that we could do this on a very Amish kind of basis. Just have a big bean supper afterwards, and I think everybody
put a big tent up.
Yeah,
and tent on the lawn.
Kelly McGillis going around spooning up potato salad for everybody.
Yep.
I don't think anybody really needs to spend any money at all. I think you make a great point.
Yep.
Should we take Phil or not?
So we can if you'd like. We have time. Phil.
Colin, Bruce.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
I do have to say that.
Well, Bobby asked me in the hallway, which music should we play? Are you kidding? Joining us now is the Chief State's Attorney, Chris Morano. He's here with us to talk a little bit about, a little bit about everything, right?
Sure.
Every time I brought something up to talk to you about, you said, Phil, big picture, bigger than that.
Yeah, so, like the weather.
Yeah, now we're like the formation of the universe or something,
The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. Well, just very quickly, I would agree that this isn't a good talk radio topic, mainly because it's boring. But for as long as I've been aware of any of these kinds of things, chief state's attorneys in Connecticut have wanted investigative subpoena power. You made one last effort to get it this time, and I guess didn't get it again. What is the importance of this? Or perhaps it's not as important as we can.
Well, first of all, I want to commend you for continuing to do what you always do, is you don't shy away from the boring when you want to talk about
this. That's right. I've never been afraid of the boring. So.
The particular problem that we were trying to address, and apparently has been attempted to be addressed in the last 10 years or so, is to come up with a way that prior to an arrest, there would be an ability to compel the production of documents or testimony from individuals. Now, most states have this in a grand jury format. Some states have it in both formats. Mm-hmm. There's about 16 states that have it in a grand jury, plus the prosecutor has an ability to have the subpoena power. It's nothing new. As a matter of fact, in Connecticut, there are about 18 agencies that have it. The Attorney General has it. Ethics Commission has it. As a matter of fact, one of the first powers the House Select Committee put forth and has used quite a bit is their power to subpoena.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a unique investigative tool. Everyone recognizes that it's an effective way to investigate.
The problem seems to be whether we want to use it to investigate criminal violations of the law.
Right. Although, it turns out, we found out today subpoena power isn't that big a deal anyway, because they subpoenaed the governor, and he just didn't show up. And they said, well, who else is here? And they said, nobody.
You know, and that's rather interesting, because ironically, when the select committee had someone who didn't show up, they then certified over to my office a request for a criminal prosecution for failure to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the irony of having to enforce a subpoena power, which I will never be allowed to have from the very chamber that won't give it to me.
Hmm. Did they do this today?
It was certified over some time ago. The problem is we really can't proceed criminally because at the present time they're exercising the subpoena individuals. They're civil and due process rights through various hearings, so it doesn't warrant a criminal violation at this point, and we've notified the committee of that. But we're standing by should they need to do that down the road.
You're technically appointed to your job by the governor, is that right? No.
No.
How'd you get this job anyway?
A lot of begging. Sometimes I wonder what I was thinking. Connecticut is unique from many other states in that our prosecutors are not elected.
Mm-hmm.
They are appointed by a criminal justice commission whose members are appointed by the governor but must be ratified or confirmed by both chambers of the legislature. Mm-hmm. So there is a bit of a checks and a balance there.
Yeah.
So we do have that separation. And, you know, politics is everywhere, but it is probably less in the office of our prosecutors than in many other states.
What if the governor didn't like you? Could he fire you, or would that commission have to fire you?
The commission would have to fire me, and there's a rather elaborate process that they would have to follow to do that.
I'm sure he's got other things on his mind besides firing you right now anyway. I wouldn't worry, but I didn't bring that up because I knew anything.
Okay. Wait, did I start to sweat a little bit here?
You're right. We don't need to harp on the investigative subpoena, but the thing I was saying to you out in the hall is I sometimes sense that there is a mentality in this state that says, well, like when Austin McGuigan was the chief state's attorney, everybody knew who Austin McGuigan was. They knew Austin McGuigan's name like the way they know Blumenthal's name, basically. And he ran around arresting people all the time. You know, that's why people knew who he was. And he arrested me 3 or 4 times, I would say, during a very short period. But there was kind
was
of...
that when you were Mirandized nude?
No, that was a whole other... I was a municipal...
Oh, I'm a visual person.
I was an MDC enforcement. There was almost kind of a sense, well, this guy, I just wonder whether people want your office to be all that powerful. I mean, maybe one reason you don't have these powers is people, I don't know who exactly, but maybe, you know, the body politic says, well, maybe we don't want that. Maybe we don't want you to be super powerful.
Well, you know, it's not a matter of power. It's a matter of effectiveness, and it's a matter of coming up with the best way to search for the truth. And if you want to have a way to investigate cases which can often rely on rumor and innuendo, and you don't have a way to really compel people to have to be truthful by putting them under oath prior to an arrest, then you're going to have shoddy investigations. You're going to have investigations that may go halfway and have ruined people's reputations and couldn't deliver the goods. It's just not the best way to do it. And if you're going to be shoddy in your investigations, your end product's not going to be that good.
Mm-hmm.
Austin McGuigan is the person who hired me years ago.
Mm-hmm.
An excellent prosecutor. He was an excellent defense attorney. He was very effective, and there is a school of thought that because of his effectiveness, we still live with the ramifications because laws changed after Mr. McGuigan left office. He was extremely effective at his job.
All right. Okay. You know, I mean, that's what I'm saying, too, right? I mean, basically, they modified the process because they thought, you know, this guy is so effective, he can get anybody. We've got to rein him in a little bit.
Well, he had his acquittals as well, but there certainly was, you know, when he stepped up to the plate, people paid attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, it isn't all about getting the publicity. It's a matter about following the unique process of the criminal system. And a lot of that has to be done quietly for a million reasons. And sometimes you're doing investigations that no one knows about and people think you're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes all of a sudden they all break and all of a sudden you have a spat of arrests and hopefully convictions.
And so let's talk about specifically this whole, one of the things that you've done specific to the Murano administration, I think, is this, what is it called, municipal corruption, something like that? What is that, political corruption unit? What is it called?
It's called the Public Integrity Bureau.
That's what
we have to. We have to keep the letters down.
PIB.
Expenses are down, so we have to keep the printing expenses down.
Yeah.
Public Integrity Bureau was established last August. For years, the Chief State's Attorney's Office was not stepping up to the plate, I felt, in the area of public corruption. The reasons given were, well, we didn't have the money, we didn't have the investigative tools, And as we saw things just becoming worse and worse in the state, I felt, we can't wait, we got to try. So in August we started, you know, we're starting from scratch. I had no funding to do it. We did it. I took what I felt were some of the best investigators from other units, put them together, and they've hit the ground running. And, you know, and we've got our fingers in a lot of things. We put up a tip line. We got a ton of phone calls. Some of them were very outlandish.
Yeah.
But filtering through some of them, we've got some things, and we're looking at things. I wish they would break quicker, but if I rush them, then I'm just opening the door for the defense down the road, and I'm not going to have integrity in the case.
Are there sufficient laws in the state of Connecticut if they're forced to, like, arrest people for, I mean, sometimes you almost get the sense of, when you hear some of this stuff discussed, are there laws against bribery? I mean, what are the laws that govern political corruption?
No, I think there are a battery of laws that can be applied. The problem that we are having is getting to uncover the facts that will let us evaluate whether those laws have been violated. When you are dealing with a person who's engaging in violation of the public trust, these are very crude
people.
They are very shrewd, and they know how to cover their tracks. They have a lot of money. They get the best lawyers. And you really have to come up with a way where you can you know, even the playing field to uncover the facts. That's where we're deficient in the state, and that's where I feel the investigative subpoena would help us. And everyone else who's doing in this type of work is using an investigative subpoena format. The Feds, the Ethics Commission, you know, the Attorney General, everybody is doing that, including the Select Committee, except us.
We're talking to Christopher Romano. He is the Chief State's Attorney here. Very quickly, this is a sort of a shifting of gears, but we have a limited amount of time here, obviously. Yesterday was the Spesiowski verdict. Not good news for you and your office. I mean, how do you feel about that case? There are all sorts of questions raised by her defense attorney about sort of how that case got handled.
Well, first of all, you know, an acquittal is not necessarily bad news for the prosecutor's office. Our job, you know, is to present the case and see what happens. Right? Yeah. That sounds very politics, so I'll get right to the heart of it. How do I feel about that? And I think that that case was a very difficult, difficult case. That case came with a battle of the experts. Some experts saying one person was driving, other experts saying another person was driving. Anytime you have a battle of the experts, it very often comes out to be a draw. And a draw is not a win in the criminal process.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, there were a myriad of other issues that came up. And Jeremiah Donovan, an excellent defense lawyer, I mean, he tied in everything that hit the public's attention. But if you look at the jurors' comments today in the media reports, they really do what I'm amazed jurors are able to do. They saw through all of that, and they went right to the core of the issue. Had the prosecutors met their burden, and it really came down to the battle of the experts. And that's really refreshing to see. But it's important to note that sometimes there are cases, when you're a prosecutor, sometimes you know you have to try some cases that you may very not well not win, but you have to make sure that the rights and the victims' rights are afforded an opportunity to be heard, just as a defendant's rights are heard as well.
We're talking to Christopher Morano, Chief State's Attorney. We'll be back with a little bit more after this. Okay. We're back with Chief State's Attorney Christopher Morano, who I think got tired of us making fun of him for picking on janitors. And so there's like another side to this janitor story, right? But I didn't.
Oh, well, there's two sides to every story, unless you're the prosecutor.
Right.
Well, yeah, I know you. It made for great amusement that our first great case was to get this janitor.
Yeah. The head janitor.
He was the head janitor. But also what was never brought out, I think, to you, is the fact that he was the chair of the Democratic Party. Not that I would just go after a Democratic chair.
No.
And he also was a candidate for police commissioner at the time the investigation was instituted. However, because of your interest and because of the short money supplies we have,
I'm going to get served here.
I'm going to ask you to keep track of a key piece of evidence that I have here in an evidence bag. Could you store this till the trial? It's a
some rubber gloves?
Pair of gloves and a toilet bowl brush.
Actually, I need those.
Yeah. No, you can't use it, but could you store it when the trial comes up?
The janitor wasn't doing any work. These are in mint condition.
Well, this is part of our case.
Is this a real evidence bag?
That's a real evidence bag.
That's so exciting.
I know. Calm down. Yeah. It's washable. So. Calm down.
I've got an evidence bag.
So I want you to take care of that evidence, but do recall and do remember he was not just the head janitor.
Yeah.
He also was the chair of the Democratic Party and a candidate for police commissioner.
You know,
and so that's where justice went, where it went.
Now, how much, and this means the Public Integrity Bureau, how many people are actually working there? I mean, what kind of, you know?
Well, I've staffed it with five five inspectors, which are police power individuals. I have two attorneys in there. I'm hoping to put another attorney in soon. I'll compare that to the investigative team for the Senate Select Committee. That has 12 investigators working full-time and a battery of attorneys.
How many attorneys are in a battery?
A battery? Well, it depends if it's the size C or size D. But, you know, I suffer not only from resource envy and subpoena envy and all sorts of other envies, but we're going to keep doing what we have to do to try and address this type of a criminal problem.
So, in other words, for the one case that they're working, it sounds like they have a lot more investigators and a lot more attorneys than you have to get everybody else.
That's true.
Yeah. The only we want them to get,
Nothing gets by you.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to help out here.
Did you have something you wanted to address about the sneaker problem?
Well, yeah, my environmental unit had also received a complaint about a biohazard issue with some sneakers.
Yeah.
So I'm just full of things.
He's brought comedy props.
You know what? This isn't television. I'm blown. Here, this is your biohazard.
A biohazard bag for me.
For your sneakers.
And for you, you might get stuck. There's a face mask.
Thank you very much.
And also the entire biohazard suit.
Oh, look at this. Austin McGuigan was never this funny.
Well, what can I tell you? Then I'll leave that alone. So, and by the way, all of these are well below any monetary limit.
But we're allowed to take anything.
I know, and I've heard that about you.
We don't have any of these ethics rules here. Don't worry about that.
Thank you.
No, as a matter of fact, now that you've given us, if you want us to play a record that, like, your cousin recorded or something. That's a joke, all right? We will play the record, all right? Yeah. All right, you have some other little funny thing you want to hand over there?
I think I'm all set.
You're on the heart. Oh, you want this parking valet, isn't it? No, that's what you want. Christopher Morano, thank you very much for joining us. Chief State's Attorney Christopher Morano.
All right,
we're back, and we're going to take a brief pause from the world of criminality and impeachment and war to contemplate the origins of the humble hamburger. Because, in fact, let me just explain how this whole thing happened. We're about to welcome as our guest Professor John Harmon from Central Connecticut State University. And the reason for this is that earlier this week, circulating around this station was one of these, sort of cheese ball PR firm things to book a guest and stuff like that. If you read it really carefully, it was supposed to be about the origins of the hamburger and, like, the 100th anniversary of the creation of the hamburger or something. And then if you read it really carefully, it's like Hardee's or somebody, but they had some expert going around, talking. So I said to Bobby, let's not put these people on the air because they're shills and whores, basically, but let's actually find somebody. Well, they are. Let's find somebody who actually knows something about this. And so then I went on the web and I started looking around. Well, it turns out one person who knows something about this is, like, right down the road from us. His name is John Harmon. He's a professor at Central Connecticut State University, and he's actually written eloquently, I might add, on the origins of the hamburger and on the burning or perhaps sizzling debate about where this actually happened. So he's with us now. Hi.
Hello there.
What are you actually a professor of, out of curiosity?
I'm a professor of geography.
Oh, well, then that makes total sense. Then,
it does.
And basically there are, I believe, if I recall your paper, four possible sites that are in contention, right?
Yeah, there are. And, of course, people who live around each one of them are completely convinced, beyond any doubt at all, that theirs is the real one.
Yeah.
And they don't get too upset about it. They all have their own little festivals, except for New Haven, and they all seem to have a good time. So I'm perfectly willing to let all four of them consider themselves the originators.
Now, one of the sites is, as you say, New Haven.
Yes,
New Haven, Connecticut. Yeah. And it's Louis' Lunch.
It is Louis' Lunch.
And what is the nature of, why does Louis' Lunch think or claim that it is the originator of the hamburger?
It all goes back to the Lassen family, who claimed that either in 1895 or in 1900 that he started grinding them up. He used to originally serve thin sliced steak sandwiches and started grinding up and serving them as meatloaf or patties to his family, and that he started doing it in 1900 at Louis's Lunch, which was not in the location that it's at now. It was moved when New Haven Hospital, I think Yale New Haven Hospital expanded in the early 1960s. And it wasn't until then that they started making a big deal about it. At that time that they were threatened with demolition.
You can't do this to us. We invented the hamburger.
That's right.
Yeah. And First of all, did you and your researchers find that in to sort of paraphrase Bill Clinton, it depends on what your definition of hamburger is?
Actually, I don't think that was the issue. Okay. They were all talking about, you know, ground beef in between, you know, either slices of bread, toast, or bun. And the early ones were slices of bread. Lewis's lunch still serves them that way.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really knows when the bun came in. But no, they're not arguing about what the hamburger is. They all agree that once you put ground up hamburger between, you know, a piece of bread, that it's a sandwich and it's called a hamburger.
So what you're going to do, rather than resolve this, is just sort of, you know, allow for all four of them to sort of say, think whatever they want?
Well, to lay it out. Now, if, for example, the people at Lewis's Lunch were once quoted as saying, let me make sure I get this right, that they have signed, dated, and notarized affidavits saying they served the first hamburger sandwiches, but they haven't shown them to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, and I couldn't get any to, there's really no sort of original documentation, you know, that an historian would really like, but there is a photograph from the 1904 Midway at the St. Louis World's Fair showing the word hamburger being served there, and that's really probably the only and oldest real documented fact. The rest of them are self-promotions.
Yeah.
You know, shows and horrors. No, that's not.
those are the people that wear it for parties. I wouldn't lump these historic sites in any way with them. And I mean, I guess it's sort of also, and probably this is the thing that attracts you, is that. The tourism and, you know, and sort of just sort of geographical self-identification and stuff like that, it all sort of, there's a real interplay among these things anytime you have some little claim to fame, right?
Yeah, there really is. And Seymour, Wisconsin probably makes the biggest deal out of it. They have an annual hamburger festival. They have, you know, grilled the world's largest hamburger. There's a wonderful photograph on my website of a guy sort of sliding over this thing, dumping salt on this burger, which looks like the size of a trampoline.
Mm.
And Hamburg, New York used to have a festival around it, but it's sort of a more generic festival. I don't know what they do in Athens.
Athens, Texas,
mm-hmm. Right. As to whether they make a big thing about Fletcher Davis, who is their originator of the Hamburg, and I'm not quite sure what they do. I didn't have enough money to, like, drive down there and individually see them, so I have not actually been to Seymour in Athens, but I'm looking forward to going there sometime.
I'm guessing you're up for one of those MacArthur grants pretty soon.
I don't think so.
Travel lenders will be pretty much unlimited at that point. So, and so we also don't know, and this will be, I promise, my last question about this, we also don't know what year, right? Because depending on who you believe, then the year gets to be different.
Yeah, 1895, 1900, 1905, somewhere in that 10-year period.
Yeah.
Which was a tremendously interesting period in American history. It was all kinds of new things, you know?
Yeah.
And that really is it. Nobody is claiming anything older than that. Although they were serving Hamburg steak, which, you know, was on a plate without a bun.
Mm-hmm.
There are menus that go back to 1834 in Delmonico's and for Hamburg steak. So the notion of what hamburger was already out there. Yeah.
And Thomas Jefferson speaks of a Whopper, but I think it's not a hamburger, as it turns out.
Yeah, well, he's ahead of his time in many ways.
Yes, John Harmon, thank you very much. From Central Connecticut State University, John Harmon, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Are you sure he was talking about the hamburger?
No, I'm thinking he wasn't. I think it was just probably something else. All right, well, you know, Christopher Morano is pretty funny. I think he's got to be the funniest Chief State's Attorney we've ever had. And he did bring in all these, he brought in biohazard stuff because of these stinky shoes I had.
Yeah, but you know what?
What?
You know what? This is his first time in here.
Yeah.
Right? And he probably thought he was going to get hammered. So I figured if he came in with this stuff.
The funny stuff, yeah. And the
other kind of loosen things up.
Janitor stuff in it and everything.
And then we would.
Well, he's sort of engaging, actually.
He is. He's nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So.
Of course, then again.
I hate it when people come in here and they turn out to be engaging and then I don't want to make fun of them anymore. It sort of deprives me of the opportunity.
Well, he kind of took the wind out of that janitor thing.
Yeah. Well, we got a lot of mileage out of the janitor.
Well, yeah.
I don't feel too bad about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to sort of help people who are just tuning in, catching up with the day's news, there was, over the state capitol today, I don't know. I'm now listening to several different interpretations of this or who the winners and losers are in all this, but... it got as ugly, I think, as it has ever gotten in the House Select Committee, the Committee on Impeachment. And as I said at the beginning of the show today, I mean, both Matt Dwyer and I were up there for this, but the committee basically, in the person of John Wayne Fox, one of its two chairs, took the position basically that the Rowlands,
was Mr. and Mrs. Governor and Mrs. Rowland, had been subpoenaed to come in here today and explain why they hadn't produced the records and where these records are and what the heck is going on. They had been subpoenaed on Sunday, and they'd been told in that subpoena that either their hinies were going to come in or somebody else's hiney was going to come in on behalf of them.
Hineys appeared, however.
No, well, the several hineys appeared, but the first hiney that appeared...
Not any talking hiney.
Yeah, was attached to William Dow, who's the lawyer for John Rowland, the private, non-taxpayer-funded lawyer for John Rowland. And he said that not only was John Rowland's hiney not in the committee room, but his hiney was not prepared to testify under oath. At which point, take a little page from the book of Bones McCoy, he said, "I'm a lawyer, not a witness." So he said he was not going to go under oath, and he was prepared to argue with the committee. He was prepared to argue and make a pest of himself, but he was not prepared to actually testify under oath as to where anything was. At which point, he was sort of, and this was an unusual tone to hear taken on both sides, but particularly on the side of John Wayne Fox, the co-chair of this committee. And the committee has really kind of taken a high road all the way through this, and has gone out of its way to make accommodations and say, sure, take your time, do what you need to do, or...
They would for ordinary citizens like you and I.
Yeah, we can read that.
Yeah, we wouldn't have any problem whatsoever.
Yeah. And the mood changed there. Now, I mean, why the mood changed, we can speculate, but the mood had changed, and Co-Chairman Fox, clearly, I think, speaking for the overall mood of the panel, just said, you know what, we don't want to hear you, you can't talk, your motion to quash the subpoena is out of order. We're done talking to you, and as far as we're concerned, your client didn't answer a subpoena, so that's not good. And after he sort of repeated that process with Mr. Cassell, the lawyer for the First Lady, Patricia Rowland, he then instructed committee staff to draft an article of impeachment. Well, this is a Rubicon to be crossed, and I don't know how significant it is. And we can talk a little bit more about that when we come back. But, you know, something happened today anyway that has not happened so far.
Bruce and Colin shall return.
Now, I wanted to give some crime-fighting news from one of my personal crime-fighting heroes, Chief State's Attorney Christopher Morano. But, you know, he started that Municipal Corruption Office, or what are they called? Political Corruption, Municipal Corruption. Remember that?
It could be said
that they have missed every big case of any significance here in the state of Connecticut for the last few years. But they bagged a big fish today. They've announced that they have arrested the head custodian at Old Saybrook High School for allegedly having school employees do work for his private business on school. And these guys, they're not afraid of anybody. They don't care how big a janitor you are, all right? A lot of people would be scared to take on the head janitor at Old Saybrook High School.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say, he's too big, he'll crush us.
Yeah.
But Christopher Morano...
You can understand maybe one of the subordinates.
Yeah.
You know.
So they didn't go after Roland. So they didn't go after any of these other people, all right?
Your mom.
Mary, Mary, why you bugging?
Well, by the way, that'll be the last time we ever run the janitor thing. I think we have to kill it now. But that was why Christopher Morano wanted to come on the show today. It was because he was tired of getting teased by people about that little... the janitor thing, which that by the way, the whole thing came up. That happened, I don't know, a couple months ago or something like that. And as he put it on the show today, and I really had not known this, that the guy in question was, in addition to being the head janitor, he was like on the town committee or head of the town committee or something like that.
Yeah, and he was running for police commissioner
or something like that. So you know, it's not like he was nobody. And you got to cut your teeth on somebody anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're cutting him some slack now.
Right.
Now joining us is a special correspondent from the Phantom Zone. It's Mary from New Hartford.
Todd.
Yes.
How are you?
You're on the air.
Good.
You're not on the air.
Yes, you are.
No.
I have a question.
Yes?
Serving in the judiciary.
Yes.
Serving in the legislature.
Uh-huh.
What's the third one?
The executive branch.
Okay.
What do I win?
Well, isn't it true that the lawyers are not supposed to be serving in the legislature?
No, it's not.
You don't know that?
No.
Because I know I've had people question that.
Did the voices in your head tell you that the lawyers are not supposed to be serving in the legislature?
Well, because it was supposed to be separate, each one. And can you serve in two at the same time?
Well, you're suggesting that a lawyer, because he's an officer of the court,
right,
is part of the judiciary branch? Well, that's, but that would be a flawed assumption. He's a lawyer in private practice is not part of the judiciary branch.
No. But when they run for office and they become a legislator.
Yes.
See?
Yeah, I know. So now they're part of the legislative branch, but they're not part of any other branches. They're just part of the legislative branch.
Uh-huh. Even though they're attorneys, huh?
But they were a judge. Being an attorney doesn't make you part of any particular branch of government. Being an attorney is a private matter.
Okay.
All right. Well, either that or you are the most revolutionary, out of the box thinker to call the show in a long time. But we prefer to think of you as the most revolutionary out of the institution thinker to call the show. You're very welcome.
Thank you. All right. Okay. But that was just people have asked me that, and I thought, well, I'm going to ask you because I just heard you had Chris Milano.
Yes, exactly.
Very intelligent. Huh?
Very intelligent, very personable young man. Do people come and ask you routinely about matters of public policy and that kind of thing? Ask you to resolve
disputes? They call me to vote the right way, like tomorrow, or rather today I got called to vote against our budget,
which
is going to be voted on Tuesday. This is the regional number 7.
Oh, yes.
And it covers 4 towns, Colebrook, New Hartford, Barkhamsted, and...
Yes, we know about regional school number 7. So you're going to vote against the budget?
Yes.
So, because you don't want to fund education so you can drive around in your lemon yellow Oldsmobile?
No, because of the money that they're throwing away.
Yeah.
And it's a disgrace. Because,
I hate it when they spend money on those kids trying to actually improve their minds and stuff like that.
Well,
when they
come to
your tax base, your taxes go up on your car. What kind of car do you drive?
Are you paying taxes where you live?
Yes, I have to go. Bye. Nice to be able to turn away from the ugly news of the wars and the impeachment and the crimes being committed and focus instead on the pristine world of sports. So today, former NBA star Jason Williams was acquitted of manslaughter on the shotgun slaying of a limousine driver of his mansion, but was found guilty of trying to make the shooting look like a suicide and also found guilty of hanging around with globetrotters.
In the NBA, it's called faking.
It's time for Sports on Trois, the very French sports discussion segment. Avec Monsieur Ambrosio, Monsieur Stevens, and myself.
You know, anybody who appears on Sports à Trois or on the Bruce and Collins show feel very...
Red Sox player of the game and stuff like that. We should have sort of the legislator...
We should!
Legislator who, like, be found passed out in his own urine at his desk.
What time did
the
they get done last night?
4 a.m.
Oh! Did we have anybody there till 4?
Yeah, Art Bell.
If you have me on Bell cover the legislature, that's actually a brilliant idea. Oh, we're almost out of time for the
question. All right, let's do the question.
All right, Mr. Ambrosio.
Yes.
I've read that dinosaur bones and skeletons are often found covered by many meters and in some kinds...
As they have been in Rocky Hill.
Yes, and sometimes miles of dirt and debris over the millions of years since their existence. Where did all this dirt and rock come from? Has the Earth been adding dirt and rock since the days of the dinosaur?
Tommaso dropped it off.
Yeah, okay.
The Tommaso Corporation pretty much dropped it off on there. No, I mean... the dinosaurs in the prehistoric days had the amazing talent of being able to dig under the ground, even when they were dead, to bring up dirt to cover themselves. It's basically an act of burying themselves.
Yeah.
The dinosaurs knew they were about to be deceased, so they used their little paws or their big paws, and they pretty much dug under the earth, brought dirt up, and then basically fell into the hole themselves, and then the other dinosaur kind of helped them. That's where the first funeral directors and the first burials took place, back in prehistoric times.
That was an especially good one.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emily.
My pleasure to be here.
Proud of yourself?
I think we can all say it in one certain way.
All right, Mr. Ambrosio.
Thank God.
Are you ready for it?
Yeah. Did you see Dunaway, by the way, last week in Java? I think he's taking a 3-2 lead on you.
You're
going to have to keep score. And he goes, I haven't been out in a while.
Yeah.
And someday we'll talk about the pressure of working with that morning crew.
It's early in the season.
God. I think more hair fell out, as hard as that is to believe.
Were you working with the morning crew?
Last week.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's where I was. You don't listen to the morning show either?
Sometimes I do.
Roy and Debbie is worth listening to.
I enjoy the Roy and Debbie show.
We'll go to Toad and Bars from 10 to 3, but come on, Roy and Debbie's good.
Either. I like the show. I often listen to it. I would recommend it to anyone.
On Tuesday, July 27th, you won't walk.
I do think, I couldn't get Al Franken, when he was on the show earlier today, too interested in this, but I do think what's happening in Fallujah is kind of amazing. I mean,
the whole thing is pretty amazing.
If you look at page 812 of the New York Times, for example, you can see this picture. Well, I mean, we have to back up and explain this. Basically, what they're doing is they're pulling the Marines and, you know, all the U.S. forces out of Fallujah, and then they're getting all these guys who, as far as I can tell, were like the guys that we were fighting against in the war. The guy, and they're saying to them, you know how we said you were bad and we took all your guns away and, you know, made you disperse and stuff like that? Well, come on back. We'll give you some guns and you fight these guys, all right? We like you now. You can fight these guys.
In your best interest to do that.
And they actually have a name for them, too. They're called the Fallujah Protective Army. The Fallujah
So there would
Protective
be the FPA?
The FPA.
Yeah.
The fighting men of the FPA. But these are like the bad guys. These are the guys that we said were the bad guys. And as far as I can tell, nobody really knows even who they really are. You know, they were like guys who were in Hussein's army.
What is their reaction to this?
Well, they say, good, give us our guns. We like to shoot people. But, I mean, I don't know what their... I don't know what their reaction is, because really what our forces are saying is, we're really tired of getting our asses kicked here. You're in the front lines now. You go fight these guys who hate us. You know these guys who hate us? You go fight them, okay?
This is just something to throw out. But let's say, for example, these guys who were fighting us before, and they hated us before,
mm-hmm.
and we took their guns and stuff away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say, for example, we give them their guns back,
yeah.
and all of a sudden they take up with the insurgents and start fighting against our forces again. Then what?
Yeah, because most of the insurgents are people who would have hated Hussein, too. So, I mean, Twitter, the guy who's leading them is the guy who's the head of the new Fallujah Protective Army, who is a former general who served under Saddam Hussein. So, I don't know. I mean, it just doesn't seem like the most sound strategy possible. It's like the...
And the German spies build a paradise in Rome. My ship's aglow with a million crews. And rubies fill each room. The sun sits high.
And joining us now to talk about their ship, I think we have both of them, not 100% sure actually, but certainly Rand Cooper, occasional cultural correspondent for the show, and film critic Deb Horblow, I think, is also there. Are you both there?
You're stuck with both of us.
Oh, this is great. So you guys were among the lucky few who went out. Was this the sort of the maiden voyage of the QM2?
Well, it was the maiden voyage out of Manhattan. It had just finished its first crossing, you know, from Southampton.
Yeah.
And I guess they actually unveiled it in January, and they'd spent some time floating around the Caribbean, I think, just to make sure that it was seaworthy before they made their first North Atlantic crossing, which apparently was quite boisterous.
So
weather-wise and tide-wise.
Yeah.
They had big waves.
They had 30-foot waves and 70-mile-an-hour winds.
And everyone stayed in their rooms.
Yeah, everyone was sick.
Yeah.
But that's not your trip that you're talking about.
No, we had, you know, it was on Golden Pond out there. It was beautiful.
And, tell us, just give a little sense of this. First of all, this is the biggest damn boat in the world, right?
It's huge.
Yeah.
Kirk, you talk.
Well... Yeah, by the way, has all of the hard facts about the boat. I have a few vague James Dean impressions.
Would you like to know how long it is?
Yes, well...
It's over 1,100 feet long. It's three times the Titanic size, 21 stories high. It holds 2,600 passengers and a crew of 1,200.
And that's a pretty rich ratio of attention.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it last weekend. I was driving down the West Side Highway, and it was actually jackknifed across the highway. But
wouldn't that big conference? What is your staff to host ratio on your show?
Staff to host ratio. There's more hosts than staff. Let's put it that way. Let's start with that.
Well, on this boat, you're going to get substantially more personal attention than you and Bruce get from the staff there.
Yeah, like how much
one would hope.
When you're in the dining room, for instance, inside the restaurant, every time you take a sip from your glass, there's someone at your elbow refilling that glass, which becomes a very dangerous thing depending on what you're drinking. But it's just amazing.
Oh, so it matters not what you're drinking? We're not just talking about your water glass, then.
one of the nice features of what one was drinking on this trip, because this was a press junket, We went out and floated around sort of aimlessly for two nights outside Manhattan. Actually, the first night we spent right in Harbor, where we had a spectacular view of the West Side.
And the parking lot, where my car was.
Right in the parking lot. But a beautiful view, and we pulled out the next day and went under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. Now, you probably have read, and many of your listeners probably have also, that the boat was designed, the only limitation on the size of the boat when it was designed, the vertical limitation, was that it had to be able to get under the Verrazano Narrows Bridge at high tide. They designed it so it would have 13 feet of clearance at high tide, and they apparently delayed our departure so that we would pass under the bridge at high tide. And there was this gasp of suspense and terror from the people who were looking, who were up on the decks watching, because there's this optical illusion that you're not going to make it. And it was like a scene from a disaster movie.
They probably have collision anyway. It would just be a matter of exchanging cards with the bridge. Now, this thing was built in France, is that true?
It was. You know, the QE2, which this has, is in effect replacing, and which it is 150 feet longer than, and is sort of interestingly stylistically very different from. The QE2 was built in Scotland. This ship, while it does have an English designer, the boat designer was a man named Stephen Payne, who has designed a lot of cruise ships for different lines.
Honey, didn't you do your homework on that?
Well, you know, one prepares. The ship was, I think, a little embarrassingly built at Saint-Nazaire in France.
Yeah, I actually think Queen Mary wouldn't approve of that.
No, I certainly don't. They should call it, you know,
I also want to hear something about Hornblow's Dramamine intake. Is this true that you took Dramamine to be on ship?
We heard, you know, stories about the perilous and really wildly adventurous and roller coaster like first passage. I'm sure up on the bridge they were delighted because the boat was built specially to be able to brave the North Atlantic. So 30-foot waves, the blackjack dealer in the casino was telling us, you know, people were ashen-faced, and all the staff was enjoying it. So this little jaunt of ours was as Deb said, it was like on Golden Pond. It was placid. But Hornblow was popping the Dramamine. Every time I turned around, there she was, popping another Dramamine.
Very discreet. I'll have you know, they're the chewable children's kind. You know, but I have the kind of seasickness, and I'm not kidding around about this. If I'm on a boat that is tied to the dock, I will, within a matter of minutes, start feeling seasick. I kid you not.
But could you feel anything on this boat? Could you even tell that you were on a boat?
You tell him. Cooper, you were listing and leaning, and it wasn't because of what we had to do.
Well, you do what? I mean, even in these placid seas, you know, a couple dozen miles off the coast in good weather, you are struck by the power of the ocean and its ability to play as a toy with even the most immense creation of man. So you are walking, sort of cockeyed down the hall, and when you imagine multiplying that effect by 20 or 30, you then have the very impressive experience of being in the North Atlantic in the middle of a terrific storm, and you know, it's something that you have to really like to do, otherwise you're going to really hate to do it.
And last question, because we're running out of time, I take it this is the kind of place where you gamble? Is that what you do on a ship like this?
Because this was like a PR joint and junket and absolutely free, we felt it incumbent upon ourselves to lose a substantial amount of money, of my money, at the blackjack table. And there was one curious feature, one of the many features that didn't seem entirely Cunard and British-like, was that the blackjack dealers, these trash-talking maniacs.
They were hilarious.
Yeah, they're like kissing me as I'm losing my money. They're gloating. I've never encountered a gloating blackjack dealer, and I certainly didn't expect to do it on Cunard.
Like, what would be a typical remark that a gloating dealer would make?
Oh, well, you know, it was like chortling. First of all, it was sort of chortling, and then, you know...
Because you kept reacting to the question.
He wasn't, like, talking about your mama or anything like that. So.
Yeah, like, I was dissing him, but you used to sort of, in a friendly way, dissing the blackjack dealer, and they respond with just a stoic smile. But these guys loved it. And I, in fact, I like that as a model for blackjack.
I wouldn't count on Fox to do that anytime soon. Deb Hornblow and Rand Cooper, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks,
bye.
Ahoy.
Ahoy, yeah. know there's so many things we didn't get to talk about this week and talk about today because we had so many interesting guests here. And boy, if you missed the show, I mean, you missed Al Franken, you missed the Chief State's Attorney Chris Marano. We talked about the origins of the hamburger. We talked about the QM2. We talked about the war. We talked about the impeachment of Governor Rowland. It was the burgeoning impeachment of Governor Rowland. And even so, we failed to get to the fact that the University of Connecticut is now teaching, offering a course in mad cow disease. I don't think you actually have to get mad cow disease to pass the course, but it's the first case in the United States of just a class that's about this disease, I think, anyway. And so, like, if you're flunking mad cow disease, that would be kind of a strange feeling. And also, you know, one thing we didn't talk about, I can't even figure out, sometimes, like, these little sort of pop cultural things happen. If you're not paying attention, you miss this whole thing that everybody else is talking about. I missed the whole wedding dress guy phenomenon. You know, this is this guy out in Seattle who put up on eBay this wedding dress that he was modeling. He wrote this whole essay about how it was his ex-wife's wedding dress, and he was wearing it. He's this big tattooed guy, and he made all these jokes about his ex-wife on this site. He got 11 million hits on the site. The $1,200 wedding dress went up selling for $3,908 or something like that, almost $4,000. But now, as is so often, and his thing was pretty funny too. For example, he wrote that he wasn't sure he would be able to get his head through the neck hole, and then he realized that she got her big old Texas cheerleader hair through that hole, so he'd be able to too and stuff. I mean, his little essay was really kind of funny, although it was extremely hostile towards his ex-wife. Anyway, it now turns out that he made up a lot of the details of the essay. Meanwhile, he's about to go on the Today Show, and he's getting calls from all over the country, and he's insanely famous. He got 3 marriage proposals from this, but it also turns out that some of the things he put in this little essay weren't true. And according to the Seattle Times, he was charged with domestic violence assault in the 4th degree last year, and with interfering with the reporting of domestic violence. Charming though he was. There was a dark side to the wedding dress guy. So no sooner did I find out about him than the bubble burst very quickly, too. But we want to thank everybody who helped out with today's show. We really did have, as you said, some interesting guests, including Al Franken, Christopher Marano, the chief state's attorney. We had Rand Cooper and Deb Hornblow, fresh back from the maiden voyage of the QM2, or the near maiden voyage of the QM2. And we had the hamburger guy, John Harmon.
Yep.
Did you cover it all?
I think you got it all.
Yeah. And many things were talked about and lives were lost. And we'd like to thank our producer, the execrable Bobby Sherman, whatever his name is. That guy. The guy back there? That guy.